Hello, Bill.
Happy New Year, Matt.
Happy New Year to you, and Happy New Year to you, all of you out there watching us on Logging Heads TV.
Hope you had an enjoyable holiday season.
I did. It was quite nice. Good getaway. Spent a lot of time with the family, a lot of time working on the book that I'm writing. But good to, you know, there's something nice about getting back to regular order. So it's good to be back.
Well, the day that the kids go back to school is a mind clearing moment. It was like a week and a half we were off. That's too long. I've suddenly become a huge proponent of year round schooling ever since I've had children. It makes tons of sense to me now.
Well, people don't realize. I mean, well, not ever. Some people realize, but people that don't have kids don't realize. Like, if there's a snow day or a 2 hour delay or, you know, or a spring break or whatever, that takes a toll on, you know, on everyone. And if you're, you know, if you're, you know, working or something, you have to have a plan for that. So.
Both me and my wife, we work, but we both work out of the house. So when that's something that happens, we are able to be around and juggle things. We both had to go to offices. So I don't even, I guess folks like those situations have nannies, and that's how they take care of it. But
still, there's no way you can both work with the kids there. I mean, it's just, well, maybe one of you can run interference, but
right,
for a little bit while the other gets some work done. But man, and then just, you know, God, I love my kids so much, Bill, but what's the Ozzy Osbourne line? Everybody's like, I love you all dearly, but you're driving me effing insane. You know, there's some truth to that, you know?
But Washington has returned as well as the school's opening, and it was a rollicking first day back in the house. Did you have a sense coming in that the anti-Banner revolt was picking up steam? Were the offices of the Daily Caller cheering with every yo-ho shout out on the house floor?
Well, you know, first of all, you have to remember a couple things. One, journalists, even center-right journalists, are very skeptical and cynical. So I think everybody was skeptical that anything was going to happen. On the other hand, you're rooting for the story. I mean, everybody's sort of rooting. Not that you have a stake in it, but wouldn't it be great if it came close, right? That would be fun to write about. So I think you sort of had these conflicting, you know, instincts or urges. You know, on one hand, you're cynical and skeptical, and it was closer. I mean, you know, the rebellion had more votes than I thought. But I do have to say, I don't know if you read. Did you read Mick Mulvaney's Facebook post, Bill?
I did. I saw it linked off your Twitter feed this morning. I did read it.
Unbelievably good.
Right. So this is a congressman who voted against Boehner 2 years ago,
yeah,
but voted for Boehner this time and explained his reasoning to his constituents.
Exactly. And, I mean, he had a lot of reasons, including the fact that I think he got burned last time, that there were people who had pledged to vote against Boehner who then chickened out. But, you know, I mean, the bottom line is, you know, they could have done this in November on a secret ballot. They could have been much more, you know, organized, orchestrated about it. And this was, it was a fool's errand. It was doomed to failure. Louis Gohmert is not ever going to be the speaker, as Mulvaney points out. And the irony that I wrote about today at the Daily Caller, I mean, the guy who ended up emerging as the prime rival to John Boehner is a guy named Daniel Webster, who has, I believe it's a 57% Heritage Action rating on their scorecard. And I think it's like a 67, I may be off by a number too, but like, I think it's only a 67% rating by the Club for Growth. This is the great conservative hope that they were burning the phone lines up, you know, going to the wall for, to elect a hardcore conservative speaker who has a failing grade by Heritage Action scorecard. Which Mick Mulvaney points out. If you haven't read it, folks, find it. This Mick Mulvaney wrote, this is a great, I mean, essentially it's everything I've been telling my readers for years now, but he has more credibility in the sense that he's a convert, You know, he voted against Boehner 2 years ago and saw that not only did it not accomplish anything, but he believes that it actually was counterproductive.
Well, but still, it was it was a bigger anti-Boehner vote than last time. It actually held Boehner to 216 votes, which actually is below a majority of the full House.
Yeah, because of the Cuomo funeral.
Right. Because a lot of Democrats didn't show up. It reduced the number of people in the room. You need a majority of those in the room. And he had that. But everybody showed up and everybody voted as they did. And Democrats all voted against Boehner. Boehner would have come up short. He would have gone to a second ballot. Now, maybe some of those Republican votes would have moved over if it actually was close. But it still suggests, you know, a weakness, a division in the Republican caucus. You know, you may recall back in September, I said, good news, Democrats, you're going to lose because Republicans are going to be too divided to govern in an effective way. Is my prophecy coming proving to be true very quickly? Or do you think this is just a last gasp and Boehner and McConnell have pretty firm grasps of their caucuses now?
I'm in the middle. I don't think you've been proven right yet. I think we don't know enough yet. I wouldn't read too much into this. But you know, is it something? Is it nothing? I think it's in the middle. I think that, the Senate's going to be very important to see how McConnell does in the Senate. And if Boehner can quickly pass things in the House and McConnell's able to get some things through in the Senate, and you can start getting some momentum, that could really, I mean, you know, success cures covers a multitude of sins. I mean, you know, you see sports teams. Here we go in the new year with some of my football analogies. But, I mean, you know, nothing succeeds like success. If you have a football team that's struggling, there's griping and backbiting, and then all of a sudden you start winning some games, things tend to, heal themselves. So, you know, I think it's possible that this is, you know, that this won't end up being a big deal. But yeah, I mean, look, it was closer than I thought, and Boehner has already started, you know, meting out some punishment. Webster and I forget who, two members already have lost, I think, seats on the Rules Committee. And I would suspect that there will be more punishment meted out to rebellious Republicans, which really should come as a surprise to nobody. But
you lose, you pay the price. That's generally how politics works.
You come at the king, you better kill him, kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, that's what I think. So, and then we'll see what that does. Does that put people in line? Do they become chastened, or does that radicalize people? The fact that Boehner is throwing some weight around, we shall see. Look, I think the other thing that needs to be mentioned, about this this vote, is that and Mulvaney mentions this in his. And his Facebook post, but like there were a lot of serious conservatives, like Jim Jordan, for example. People were voting for Jim Jordan to be speaker. Jim Jordan voted for John Boehner to be speaker. so that's a problem. If you're on the other side, that's a problem. If you're a Tea Party revolutionary, you need Jim Jordan to vote against Boehner. And the Jim Jordans of the caucus, the Tom Graves, whatever, you need one of them to have been running, to have a plan to win, to have been doling favors to people. You know, what's really needed, I wrote about this, a piece called How to Beat Boehner, is, you know, you do need to have a campaign and an infrastructure, and you need to, you know, are there any, you know, by the way, it's interesting. There were like, I think there were 25 Republicans who voted against Boehner, and I believe 19 of them had taken money from Boehner. during their campaigns. Right. In the case of Daniel Webster, I think it was like $25,000 or something that he had taken over the last couple of cycles from Boehner or Boehner's PAC. And then to do this, I think I'd be pissed too if I were Boehner. So, but the larger point is, if you're part of the sort of the revolutionaries, maybe you should start giving out real money to conservatives and helping them get elected, and then maybe they might owe you, you know, some favors, and you could call out that favor when it comes time to vote for a speaker or a whip or whatever.
I mean, isn't the fact that, I think what's hard for, I think, those on the left to understand is, you know, when Newt Gingrich got forced out after the 98 midterms is because Republicans had a bad midterm and they want right. Gingrich to pay the price for that. John Boehner had a great midterm. He spreads the money around. He runs the table. He wins almost all the competitive seats. Yeah, they have the biggest majority since the 20s. Why do conservatives want to take that moment to say, Boehner, you know, you're no good, get out? I mean, and presumably the fact that he did spread a lot of money around is what saved him at the end of the day, and he had a bigger cushion of a majority to play with. But what is the rationale for even considering getting rid of him at this historic moment of Republican success?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think you're right, and I think that had Boehner lost seats or had Republicans underperformed in the House, they would have used that as a rationale to oust him. Having said that, you know, I think the priority for grassroots conservatives, it's not about electing Republicans, and it's not about ideology. It's not about who's conservative. I mean, again, they supported a guy named Dan Webster who has a failing grade according to Heritage Action Scorecard. But what it is about is, it's about two things. The most negative way of looking at it is it's about building lists and raising money for conservative or, you know, outside groups. But amongst the people who really are true believers, it's about a fear that they've lost the country. It's an apocalyptic fear that things are going off the rails and that there's no time left. There's no time left to like do the sort of sensible, mature thing. That it's urgent that you stop Obama's agenda immediately and employ whatever efforts must be used to stop it. And if it fails, it fails. But you've got to try. If you're not taking swings, you can't get hits. Because it's the world won't be here 5 years. It's no use worrying about elections 5 years from now if we can win Hispanics 5 years from now or you know what the public thinks of us 5 years from now, because we may not make it 5 years from now if we don't stop Obama's agenda right this minute. And so there's a sense of an urgency, a frustration, and anger. And a lot of these folks haven't been watching politics as long as I have, because I remember that we've been saying this for my whole life. You know, if we don't do this, if Bill Clinton gets reelected, it's game over. You know what I mean? So I mean, people who've been around politics become a little jaded and cynical to these apocalyptic notions because we've been essentially saying that Bill Clinton's the most liberal politician in the history of mankind. And well, it turns out Bill Clinton's fairly moderate. he's willing to play ball, but you know. So anyway. That I think that explains the rationale. That explains what it is. And you've got all of these folks who are newly elected members of Congress. In some cases, they haven't been around politics that long themselves. And even if they have been, they're being pressured by, again, I would say, the charlatans who are pressuring them to raise money and to build lists. And the good-hearted, decent, God-fearing, salt-of-the-earth conservative folks who are really afraid and worried and passionate, who are burning up the phone lines. So that explains the rationale as good as I can explain it.
Now, outside of what's going on inside of Congress, we've had a lot of 2016 moves over the past couple of weeks. We had Jeb Bush just yesterday launch his Right to Rise PAC, which I guess will function as his exploratory committee.
I heard someone on the... I forget who she was. Somebody from The Daily Show or Comedy Central described this as a better ad for Cialis than for a Republican presidential campaign. So we'll see how that name plays out.
Well, you know, that name was taken from a Paul Ryan speech.
Yeah.
And apparently, Jeb had checked in with Paul Ryan. Is it okay if I use your phrase? And Ryan said yes, which to me greatly suggests that Ryan is not running. And certainly his taking over the House and Wayne's Committee chairmanship to spearhead tax reform also suggests his mind is not on the White House. But we also had Mike Huckabee, host of Fox News' Huckabee, quitting the show to explore a run and make a decision by the spring. And most said you wouldn't quit your show unless you really were pretty serious about running. You know, the Jeb Bush Right to Rise website talks about closing the income gap, and we're going to campaign with every constituency in the country. We're not going to leave anybody out. Mike Huckabee has really, you know, been pushing his social conservative cred very hard, attacking, you know, the contraception mandate for the government being Uncle Sugar. Do you see the divisions that we're seeing in the House about to get played out on the presidential stage as well?
Yes, I think that's entirely possible. I think that it'll be more nuanced because you're going to have all these different gradations of conservatism, right? I mean, if it was Jeb Bush versus Ted Cruz, I think it would be a very stark contrast. But of course, you're going to have, you know, you may have all different flavors in between, from Rand Paul to Marco Rubio to Scott Walker to Mike Huckabee. So it might get a little bit more muddy than that, at least first early on. But there is a spectrum amongst conservatives and a spectrum of different, whether it's ideology or whether it's temperament, level of anger, as has sometimes become the measuring stick of how conservative you are, is the level of anger you have. More angry is more conservative. So yeah, but I think this will serve as a microcosm for the larger battle schism within the conservative movement. It very well could end up settling matters if conservatives were able to, if somebody wins out in that battle of ideas and then becomes a popular president, you know, that could essentially settle things. What, you know, because there's been this identity crisis going on. So I think this primary is very important, Bill. And
do you think that both Jeb and Huckabee will gain some first mover advantage? Will Jeb be able to lock down establishment donor support and squeeze out Christie? Also, considering that Christie is sort of making a national joke of himself on a regular basis, we can talk about that.
You hate Christie. I think you're too down on Christie, Bill. I do. I'm serious.
And does Huckabee, does he now get to own the social conservative vote? Does that mean Santorum has no oxygen, that Ted Cruz has no oxygen? Does this make Ben Carson's life harder, or is announcing this quickly, you know, not relevant to how this all shakes out?
I think this, in the case of Jeb Bush, this is a big deal. I think there's a chance that Bush does get that sort of first mover's advantage or whatever it's called. I think there's a real chance that Jeb Bush can quickly shore up establishment support and money. And there's a chance that it would dissuade people like Scott Walker or John Kasich, Mike Pence, all these other governors, essentially squeeze out their fundraising potential. And Marco Rubio in Florida, for what that's worth. So I think in the case of Jeb Bush, the fact, and the other thing too is, by the way, I mean, I think the knock against Jeb Bush was always, does he have the fire in the belly? I mean, one of the knocks against him was, he hasn't run in a dozen years. Does he really want it? So I think that it was very shrewd of him to get out very early and aggressively. So in the case of Jeb Bush, I think, yes, there's a chance he can squeeze out and really seize an advantage. Maybe, I think Christie still gets in, but if Jeb Bush can shore up a lot of that early establishment money, scare off maybe a Pence or a Kasich or whatever, or a Walker, that will be a huge benefit to him, to sort of have that establishment lane to himself and the big money, and to run the kind of campaign that he's going to want to run, which is you have to lose the primary, be willing to lose the primary in order to win the general. On the other hand, I don't think Huckabee does that at all, for a variety of reasons. Huckabee's never been a great fundraiser, and so one of the reasons that somebody who get one of the reasons that you get scared out of running is that someone is going to suck up the money that would have otherwise come to you. But that's not going to happen because all these guys on the grassroots right, from Cruz to Carson to Huckabee, like number one, they're not running based on money anyway. So they're sort of going to have to live off the land, live off of earned media and press and buzz and direct mail, $25 checks coming from little old ladies and all that stuff. And so I don't think that the Huckabee move has the same effect in the sort of grassroots, I'm using the conservative Republican Party as the Bush move has much more influential in terms of shoring up the establishment support.
But you think Chris Christie is not a national punchline? You think that Christie still has some room to compete with Jeb for establishment support, or would he get a support from elsewhere?
Well, he could be he could potentially try to be a hybrid. You could argue that Jeb Bush helps him by making him the alternative, that he can sort of now say, I'm running against this dynasty guy. I don't think we need another Bush. And by virtue of having Bush, that sort of gives him a little more entree into the anti-establishment world. And maybe provides him a little cover. He would have been attacked as the establishment guy. Maybe now he can get some. He was the head of the RGA. He still gets some of the establishment money. But having Bush there shields him from the attacks and the criticism. I mean, that would be a very shrewd, smart way to play this. It could be everybody on the establishment's second favorite guy. And so, who knows how it's going to shake out. I'm not saying that Chris Christie is the best thing since sliced bread, Bill. I just think that you underestimate him, and that you I think you are a little too hard on him. I do.
Don't you think it's weird? I mean, while Jeb is spending his time honing his message, reaching out to donors, beginning to make his case for why he has the right vision for the future. Christie is spending his time going into owners' boxes. It's one thing to spend a day watching a game. Every politician does things that are sociable and not about, meat and potatoes politics. I'm not saying the guy has to live a life of a monk. But it's weird that after he does this weird hugging spectacle, they then spends his time talking about it endlessly and then pledges to go to the next game and do the same thing in the next guy's owner's box. I mean, you would think he would recognize that this is not good attention, this is bad attention, and he should find a way to start talking about, presidential stuff so he can, be seen as on the same platform, the same level of gravitas as Jeb. It just seems like he doesn't have a good radar, a good sense of self to know when he is being self-indulgent and not being presidential.
I think that this is a common lament that I have about all the Republicans and conservatives who are running. That they're sort of all self-indulgent. They don't want to do the hard work. And I think Christie is somewhat guilty of that. I do think that the Jerry Jones thing is potentially problematic. Because for a variety of reasons. I mean, Jerry Jones is he makes his son-in-law clean his eyeglasses. I mean, that's the kind of guy he is. He kind of makes Dan Snyder seem like a good guy. So he's sort of a villain. He's an easy to villainize. And it's not like Christie's sitting there amongst the regular folk. He's in the owner's box hugging a guy from a team that is a rival of the New York Giants who play in New Jersey.
and the Philadelphia Eagles from the swing state of Pennsylvania, right. Who then proceeded to call the worst fans in America. It just seems like...
Yeah, these are people
that may not be the best way to run for president.
These are people who throw batteries at Santa Claus. These are people who, I don't know if they have it now, but in the old Veterans Stadium, literally had a jail. They built a jail in Veterans Stadium where the Eagles would play. So these are some of the nastiest fans in America. If you've seen the movie Silver Linings Playbook, you sort of know the scene. You know, I think it was De Niro's the dad was no longer allowed to even go to the game. So, but look, you know, this is very well could be Much Ado About Nothing. But just imagine. Okay, first of all, here's what we know. We know that images matter, right? We know the picture of Lieberman kissing George Bush, or Charlie Crist hugging Obama, or Chris Christie, for that matter, hugging Obama. I mean, these images matter, and they matter much more than if it had just been written that it happened. And so what happens when Christie goes into a Michigan primary? Because they're playing the Detroit Lions. Or when he goes into Pennsylvania, a Pennsylvia primary. This very well could come back to haunt him. So I'm not going to say it's like the end all and be all, but you know, it's a weird move. You know, I probably would have advised against it, you know, to say the least.
I mean, I've always said, I probably said it to you before, you know, everyone made fun of John Kerry putting Swiss cheese on a Philly cheesesteak and calling Lambeau Field Lambert Field. But we forget that he won Pennsylvania and he won Wisconsin despite those things. So I am duly aware that these so-called gaffes aren't necessarily what really factors into a voter's mindset. But I do think I have no idea in a general election if that would really make him lose Pennsylvania. But it does suggest to me that he doesn't know how to – I mean, if when you're running in a primary – when you're in a presidential election, there's all sorts of things that really just are not that are beyond the campaign's control. The economic landscape, the foreign policy landscape, you know, People's Party, affiliations. Presidential campaigns really just playing around the margins and really can't do that much to change the outcome. But primaries, that's a dogfight, and you're really scratching to amongst like-minded people to say, you should trust, you know, me and not that other guy to represent your values. And just every day that he is being caught in some sort of weird spectacle like this and egging it on, which is his own, you know, it's when they have a moment of excitement and you hug somebody and it looks weird on a photo. You can't always control that. But then he is piling on to it deliberately. That just says to me that he is not in the right mindset to win a primary situation where Republican voters will be saying, who can I trust to be the best nominee in the face of my party?
All I'm saying is I think you're a little too down on him. That you don't like him. He rubs you the wrong way. And I think that clouds your – I do think it clouds your judgment. I think he's more likable and much more dangerous than you think he is, in my opinion.
Well, we shall see, sir. Now, on the Democratic side, I had a piece over in Politico earlier this week saying that the Democratic challenge for 2015, and let's face it, this is the beginning of the presidential race, they need to decide one way or the other how Obama himself fits in the party's narrative, the party brand, the party story. Is the party going to be saying, this was a great presidency, this was an historic advance of liberal progressive values, however they want to label it. You know, he saved the economy. We're on the right track. We're strengthening the middle class. There's a long way to go, but he's pointed us in the right direction, ticking off the various accomplishments. That's what Obama is trying to cue them up to do in his own speech making, which is, and he's going to go to have a little roadshow this week in advance of the State of the Union, or are they going to tilt to what Elizabeth Warren and what Bernie Sanders have been saying, which is we're experiencing a 40-year decline in the middle class, the rules are rigged for the wealthy. You know, they don't necessarily attack Obama personally, but they don't really, you know, incorporate his accomplishments in that narrative. They sort of keep it at a distance, implicitly suggesting that it's been ineffectual to arrest the middle class decline. And Chuck Schumer, who's not really in the Warren camp, he had his own speech in November where he also said Democrats lost because the middle class is hurting, and that we need to have a new program to show the middle class that we have, you know, good activist government ideas that are going to help them in the short run. He doesn't go into the whole the rules are rigged frame that Warren does. And I'm happy to tease it out more. I don't want to bore you with a long spiel. But the point is that there's sort of two separate wings of the pessimist camp. And you have Obama trying to wave the flag. Say, look, let's be optimists here. Let's be optimists about my record. And Hillary herself, you know, she is going to have, in many ways, be the final arbiter of which way the party goes for 2016. You know, all signs point to her running. All signs point to her getting the nomination. You might expect her to have daylight between herself and Obama, and I expect there'll be a degree of that. But she said in October at a speech at a National Economic Club of Chicago that our economy is the envy of the world, and the president and his team made the hard choices we needed to make to put ourselves on the right track. So she seems to be prepared to position herself as an extension, you know, perhaps an improvement upon, but still an extension of the Obama tenure. And if the party does that collectively, that's saying we want to make Obama like our Reagan. We want to say he is the one that changed the economic, changed the trajectory of America the way Reagan did, and to use Obama's phrasing from 2008, and not treat him like an ineffectual bystander. And I just think they have to make a call on that. The record is too looming and consequential to just sort of dance. They try to dance around it in 2014, and that didn't work. They got to make a choice how to characterize it. And that's, I think that's their challenge for this year.
Not to change subject, but I said Aaron Blake over at the Post has something about Daniel Webster hosting bipartisan dinner parties with, let me see what the tweet is. Conservatives tried to replace Boehner with a guy who hosts bipartisan dinners with Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So he's dead to me. Daniel Webster, good name, bad voting record. Yeah, look, what you said about Obama, a couple things I would just add quickly. I would say, number one, yeah, I don't think Hillary... I think it's very hard to run against a president of your own party. And so I think the notion that she would try to really put a lot of daylight between her policies and his, just tell me, Bill, you know you know the history stuff better than I do. I mean, I remember thinking that McCain could have scored some political points by really distancing himself more from Bush, and he didn't do it. And maybe that's an act of honor. Because, you know, because we were at war and the surge was working.
But if there's any opportunity for a guy to do that and be seen as and have it be understandable, like that was the time.
Yeah, and not to mention the fact that, you know, the two had this bitter contest 8 years earlier. But McCain didn't do it. And I think maybe it's sort of something honorable about the fact that McCain didn't do it. But I thought he should have politically. And so... But historically speaking, I mean, you know, I know this is putting you on the spot. I mean, when has a, you know, it's hard. A lot of times it's the vice president running, so you really can't do it that much, right? Because if George H.W. Bush can't really throw Reagan under the bus after being his veep for 8 years.
But he did calibrate some. I mean, he had a whole kinder, gentler nation. You know, which was a bit of a swipe at Reagan, saying that he wasn't the kindest and gentlest he should have been.
That's the implication. Yeah. Kinder, gentler machine gun hand.
I mean, it was a line he was walking. He didn't dump all over Reagan. He certainly praised his tenure with him in the convention, but he found a way to. Reagan was still kind of suffering from Iran-Contra. You know, Bush had to do some separation to say he was his own man. and he walked that line. And, you know, people dump on Gore for not campaigning, you know, side by side with Bill Clinton in 2000. But I think people do forget there was a fair amount of polling showing that Clinton was dragging him down in swing states. And sure, it would have been, if it wasn't for all the Monica Lewinsky business, it would have been a lot easier for Gore to run on the economy and have that be it. But that stuff made it harder for him. And, you know, Gore did pull it off in the vote count.
Picking Joe Lieberman as the Veep was
right.
Part and parcel of that whole effort, because Lieberman had been critical of Obama's dalliances. I'm sorry, of Clinton's. There they go.
And you could argue that Lieberman, you know, did win Florida for Gore if things were counted in a different way. Hubert Humphrey had a devil of a time in 68, you know, dealing with Lyndon trying to praise Johnson in some respects and trying to grapple with the war in other respects. And he wasn't able to walk that line and the party, you know, split apart.
It's fraught with danger. So I'm not surprised at Hillary. And by the way, I mean, the economy is improving, and I think a lot of it has to do, frankly, with things that, you know, with, you know, fracking and you know, gas prices are down. You know, none of it. Obama, in my opinion, Obama gets credit for none of it, but he gets credit for it. You know what I'm saying?
Obama disagrees with you on that point.
He deserves credit for none of it, but he will get credit for it. And so things feel like they're on an upswing a little bit. I think I don't have the polling to back it up, but I have the sense that people feel a little bit better than they did a few months ago about how things
are. There is polling to suggest that right now. And as I said in the piece, you know, if you're maintaining solid GDP numbers, if the wage growth went up in December, if that sustains, that's the big sore spot for the populist Democrats. That sure, you can say corporate profits are up and Wall Street's up and GDP numbers are fine, you're creating some sort of jobs, but if people's wages aren't going up, if they aren't good paying jobs, no one's going to feel it. And this is just more evidence that it's the same old, same old. So what's sort of the unknown is, if you're getting solid GDP numbers and that starts to lift up wages too, that really resolves that division in the party, and it becomes easier to rally around the Obama banner. If the wages don't follow suit in 2015, then you probably have a bigger debate on that score.
And I think it's always, I mean, you should always err on the side of rallying around the guy who's been the party standard bearer for 8 years. I mean, if it's a judgment call, you got to pretend that it's been a great 8 years, that he's been a great president. I mean, because the abandonment, if it's Nixon, you got to do what you got to do. But if you are in a position, that's a Hail Mary pass. And I thought John McCain needed a Hail Mary pass. But it's if your strategy is to say, yeah, you guys trusted us with the last 8 years, but we messed that up, so we're going to be different this time. That's a Hail Mary pass. That's not where you want to be. So
and now, that's basically where I come down in the article, because it is a judgment call as it stands, because that wage growth issue is you know, the jury's out where that number is going to go over the next 2 years. But I would argue, Schumer says in his speech, we need to show the public that we have a pro-government agenda that's going to directly help you. We need to be able to prove it. Well, what better way to prove it than what you've done in the past 6 years? To be able to point to your actions and say, you know, we did the Recovery Act and we stopped the recession. You know, we did the Affordable Care Act and more people have insurance and costs have been contained. There's other things like that they could be saying. And obviously there are counter arguments, but you got to make your own case. Otherwise, your argument is, yeah, we tried all those things and they didn't work, but trust me now to do something twice as big, and trust me, it's going to be really, really awesome. That's more of a leap of faith. And as David Leonard, the New York Times, points out, a lot of things Democrats talk about doing don't have immediate bangs for the buck. They're long-term reforms. We need to strengthen our bargaining power and lift up the union movement. Well, you can't do that in a month. You want to unrig the rules that favor the rich. That's not something you're going to do today. So now the Republican Congress is that you have to give you a sense that it's going to help you out in some way in the future, and that's theoretical. All you have as hard evidence is what has transpired in the past 6 years, and the fact that the numbers are turning right now, you can say, look, if you stick with these programs, you give them time to work, they will pay off. I think that's the best argument Democrats have going forward now.
Well, I think as George W. Bush famously said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, don't get fooled again.
So, any last thoughts, Mr. Lewis?
It was fun. It's fun being back in the mix, back in the saddle. I don't even know if we got to everything we wanted to talk about. It's just a lot of stuff to talk about. A lot of exciting things happening. And
you can talk about your love of handsy Joe Biden.
Did not even get to talk about that. My defense of Joe Biden and his. His alleged groping and inappropriate comments. So we'll save that for another day.
Even if you're a conservative, you're going to miss Joe Biden. You'll be sad when he goes.
There's something you got to like about Joe Biden. I'd like to have Joe, if you're watching, I know you're a fan. Let's grab a beer. Let's have a drink. Let's have a drink with Joe Biden. How cool would it be? Somebody out there watching, I'm sure knows, can get to Joe Biden. Let's make this thing happen.
So you can have a beer with one person. It's Obama, Biden, Boehner, or McConnell. Who's it going
to
be?
If I have to have a beer with one of those people?
One of those four.
This is just for pure pleasure or potential
news? Pure pleasure.
Okay, so there's not a chance I could get somebody drunk and pump them for information? Because I'd go with Boehner if that was it.
Right.
But if you're saying just for fun, it's got to be Biden. Come on.
That's right.
Close. Obama's at the bottom of that list.
Well, until next week, sir, always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you, Bill Scherer, and thank you all for tuning in. We'll see you next week here in the DMZ.